We are on page 32, the middle of page 32. What I'm going to do is after we finish the book of Nehemiah, and then I do a final edit, we'll put it on our webpage. And that way you can download it and write up your own copy and everything. I'm starting to go back and do the same things for Galatians and other books that we've covered. Do a kind of introduction and outline. Mr. AJ? You know how you would describe a trip on a magic carpet? A rugged experience. My son sent me the other day. He said, "Dad, I saw a book at the bookstore, How to Save 50%. So he said, "I bought two copies." That's right. That's right. Right. And the guy in the Civil War that couldn't make up his mind, so he wore a blue coat and gray trousers, and they shot at him from both sides. Oh, I tell you. Did I send you that meme? It has a picture of the bust of Socrates. And above it, it says, good enough. --, mediocrities. I love that. I love that. 8 years of Greek, you know, translating Plato and Aristotle. Just that great. Okay. Anyway, Nehemiah, we're in page 32, 3F. Nehemiah is having to settle the corruptions of the flesh. In chapter 4, we saw Nehemiah handle an external conflict. In chapter 5, he handles an internal conflict. I'll tell you, as I was saying to somebody, I think it was David, at the end of chapter 7, the completion of the walls is finished. But Nehemiah's work is only half done. Now he has, having rebuilt the walls, he has to renew the walk of the people. And working with people is harder than working on a wall. Walls do not have a will of their own. They are largely submissive. Working with people is difficult. If you would ask me, what do I like most about the pastorate, I would have to say, being alone in my study. That is when I love Ruth Ann dearly. I hope you all know that. And if I'm careless today, it's because I'm ruthless. She didn't come up yesterday on our work day because she played Friday night, she played last night, she'll play this afternoon in an orchestra. She is a clarinetist, that's her. She majored in music from the University of Michigan. So, I was going somewhere and I forgot where I'm going. Working with people is difficult. Working with people is difficult. My father loved working with people. I'm a little more like my mother. people can give you the greatest pleasure and the greatest heartache. I remember an older lady in one of the congregations in which I served. She said to me with Mrs. Tilly was her name. She said to me with evident feeling, she said, children, when they're young, they step on your toes. And when they get older, they step on your heart. But you're not going to get more of the Word of God into heaven. But you can get people there. So, you can't have one without the other. In fact, to be honest with you, I prefer studying in my office even more than preaching or teaching. As much as I like that, I am the most, you've heard me say this before, I'm the most ignorant man I've ever met. So he's having to deal with people. In 3F, Nehemiah records his faithfulness as an example of self-denial, hard work, and generosity towards others. He's going to give them a model to imitate. All spiritual leaders must learn the importance of being a model. You earn leadership. You earn influence. It's not bestowed upon you because of a position. Positions just give you a chance to show how incompetent you are. Real leadership is influence, and influence that is earned first by behavior, by conduct. You remember in 1 Peter, women who are married to unbelievers, how are they to win their husbands over? By what? What'd you say, Glenda? Godly conduct. Yeah. Now, I would have thought just beating them over the head with the gospel might have done it. Mm-mm. Godly conduct. That is key. You have to model the message. Incarnation. There is a sense, and David has pointed this out, there is a sense where it's the message, not the man, that's important. And that's true. But if the man misbehaves, the message is not heard. So in one sense, you never want to cultivate, and pastors can do this if they're not careful, you never want to cultivate the worship of the pastor. I've seen it done, and done really well. But that's not what we're to do. We're to model godliness. And always make sure that the focus is on Christ, not on us. But here he has to show his example. So we see that he has denied the perks of his governorship out of fearing God, unlike those who were before him. Look at verse 14. Moreover, from the time I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year, so Nehemiah is going to reign for 12 years. And then he's going to go back for a short period of time. And when he comes back, he finds that all that he had been doing is now undone. Okay? In the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the king, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers at the food allowance of the governor. It should be eight, the food allowance. I think I'm missing an E. The governor who were before me laid heavy burdens on the people and took from them for their daily rations 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants lorded it over the people. But I did not do so because of the fear of God. The fear of God is the beginning of what? The fear of God always must be in every spiritual leader's mind. He has to, Xerxes was defeated at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC when he first attempted to subdue Greece. He was so upset, he returned back to Asia Minor and pouted for a while and then died. And his son, Darius, decided, we're going to pick up where Dad failed. And by the way, he does. He's able to sack Athens. But Darius had a man stand right beside him at dinner time, every time, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. He had this man stand right beside him while he sat and ate. And this man had one job only, and it was to whisper in the king's ear, remember the Athenians. Remember the Athenians. Remember the Athenians. Because the Athenians had defeated his father at Marathon. You know, Marathon, you're familiar with Marathon? Okay. Where Pheidippides ran the 26 miles to tell Athens they've been delivered. Pardon? No, no, not at Marathon. The Spartans were invited to come, but they didn't show up. They said, we'll get there right after our religious festival. And they got there after the Athenians had defeated, under Miltiades, had defeated the Persians. Miltiades had them come into a canyon, and he had a weak center and strengthened the flanks, so that the center, as the Persians went, the center would give way gently, and then an envelopment. We're missing Colonel Stewart today.
He wasn't feeling well yesterday.
He was here yesterday.
Yeah,
I saw him yesterday.
His hip was really bothering.
His what?
Hip.
His hip?
He was really.
By the way, did you know that Hippias was the deposed leader of Athens, and he was leading the charge when they came back? I don't know, but I don't remember. I've got the mind that connects stuff, you know. But Hippias was their leader. Anyway. No, Thermopylae was the next battle. That's where the Spartans, yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, there were some other people there besides the Spartans, but they don't count that. It's not a good a story. I don't know. Don't get me out.
I think you're
already
there.
Yeah. Ruth Ann says, if you ask Lanny directions, he'll give you the history of cartography. A leader must constantly keep in mind, not remember the Athenians, but the fear of God,
Two G.
Nehemiah set an example of perseverance and faithfulness. I also persevered in the work on the wall, and we acquired no land, and all my servants were gathered there for work. Again, he's a model. Self-denial, perseverance. The other thing, we see in 3G, Nehemiah set an example of generosity, feeding others from his own food supply. Moreover, there were at my table 150 men, Jews and officials, besides those who came to us from the nations that were around us. Now what was prepared at my expense for each day was one ox and six choice sheep and birds, and every 10 days all kinds of wine in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the food allowance of the governor, because the service was too heavy on this people. He is very considerate of the condition of the people. But notice what he does at the very end. He prays, remember for my good, O my God, all that I have done for this people. So he's not asking, he's not asking for kudos from the people. He's not asking or doing one of these things, you know. Tell me how great I am, because I'm self-denial, I'm generous. And by the way, the purpose of the self-denial was so that he could be generous. Ruth Ann has a friend whose idea is to deny herself buying stuff so she can send extra money to missionaries. Very good. But he wants the Lord to remember. And that fits with the fear of the Lord. The spiritual leaders always realize that wherever they go, they have an audience of one. And that is the one they want to please most. Well, we now go on to chapter 6, 3E, external opposition. Nehemiah confronts an external threat of personal harm from a cabal. So here we've got this summary, and this is, here's what I've written. Summary of chapter 6. External opposition intensifies from contempt, chapter 4, to conspiracy to kill. Evil has an energy that continues to grow if not checked. Evil is never dormant. It has a dynamic all its own. But Nehemiah remains diligent to the work God has assigned to him. Having in chapter 4 heard the roar of the lion, 1 Peter 5:8, which is Satan, Nehemiah now meets the schemes of the devil, Ephesians 6:11. In chapter 5, while God's people were against one another, the corruption of the believer's flesh, the enemy was quiet. But as soon as sin in God's people is confronted and forsaken, he attacks once more. Now, what's the implication of that? Pardon me?
They became complacent.
When the believers were fighting among themselves, does Satan have to do anything?
No.
He could just, okay, you got, I'll stand back and watch. Watch you guys destroy yourself. But once they get united and walking with the Lord, that's when he picks up. He said, okay, I got to start stirring things up again. Nehemiah rejects the deception of a seemingly well-intended meeting with Israel's enemies, has the energy not to tire under persistent pressure. That is hard. Ignores, for the most part, the open slander of his character, verses 5 through 9, and bears with those who would undermine him and his work, whether false prophet or false brethren, verses 10 through 19. Yet by prayer and a commitment to be faithful to the work God has given to him, he refuses to become discouraged and slacken his efforts. He stays on the task. That's good. The treachery mentioned in chapter 6, verses 15 through 19, reveals that the completion of the repairing of the walls does not solve the internal problem Nehemiah must now face. The spiritual condition of the people will require further reforms, which chapters 8 through 13 will record. One major task is completed, but Nehemiah's work is far from over. Satan and those he uses appear to assume that the success of God's work is dependent on only one man, and if that one man can be removed or discredited, God's work will stop. Thus, here, Satan's tools believe that if they are successful in destroying Nehemiah, the work on the walls will be left unfinished. Nothing is farther from the truth. When Moses dies, Joshua takes over. God's workmen change, but God's work always continues, even with another person. Spiritual leaders must take care not to bring discredit upon themselves and their work, but they must never assume that they are indispensable. Because compromises can be made or rejected based on whether they are sinful or not, we saw that in chapters 1 and 3 of Daniel, spiritual leaders must have wisdom and courage that comes through a knowledge of the Word of God and prayer. Wisdom to discern when to make a good compromise and when to avoid a sinful one, and courage to remain firm when pressure is applied. Discernment is most needed when a sinful compromise may be obscured with good intentions, common sense, and appeal to avoid pain. Whether in times of latitudinarianism or crisis, the pressure to conform to a compromise that is wrong is always strong, and only those with the strength to resist it know how strong the temptation to conform is. Those who give in quickly to temptation never feel its full strength. You might find this interesting. I use the word latitudinarianism. My editor said, find another word for that. And I said, okay, times when nobody cares about what you believe. She said, okay, stick with latitudinarianism. In times of lukewarm concern, nobody cares. In times of crisis, people want you to conform for self-preservation. But did you get that last line that I wrote there? Only those with the strength to resist temptation know how strong the temptation to conform is. Those who give in quickly to temptation never feel its full strength. I must confess, I thought that was rather insightful when I wrote that. If I resist temptation for 5 minutes and then give in, do I know the strength of temptation compared to the guy that resisted it for 2 hours? Which feels the force of the wind the strongest? The oak tree or willows? The oak tree. The willows, they don't feel the full strength. They immediately collapse. They immediately collapse. We need to remember that next time we feel tempted. Since a spiritual leader's character should be reflected in his reputation, both key to his ability to lead, he should expect to find his reputation openly slandered. As Satan's chief weapon is the lie, we must not be surprised if he uses slander and false accusation. And he uses even more effectively any true accusation based on a sin that the leader commits. That'll be on the front page of the newspaper. It takes wisdom to know when it is time to refute slander and when to ignore it. Never complain, never explain. Benjamin Disraeli. Satan loves to get a spiritual leader in a constant battle of defending himself against false slander, leaving him with little or no time to do what God has given him to do. Leaders must have one blind eye and one deaf ear. In the meantime, a spiritual leader will spare himself much pain if he keeps trusting God in prayer and stays busy doing the task that was assigned by God to him. When the book of Nehemiah has much to say about leadership, but it also has much to say about the kinds of opposition spiritual leaders may face, whether personal, physical, psychological, religious, or political. Like Nehemiah, spiritual leaders will face false prophets and false brethren. If the spiritual leader is devoted to the word of God, Satan may use a false teacher with a false interpretation to lead him into sin. Thus, the leader must ever keep a firm grip on the sword of the Spirit, keeping it sharp and clean, lest he be deceived. In the process, while spiritual leaders will find from time to time comfort and strength from another true believer in the Lord, in the long run, he learns to rely most strongly on the only one who will never leave him or forsake him. Spiritual leadership is never a cakewalk, but with a humble trust in God, he gives the leadership the vision, energy, courage, and perseverance needed to complete the work. True spiritual leaders will not desert their post and duty even if a hireling does, Proverbs 28:1. Jesus did not flee from the work God gave him to do at the cross. Paul remained faithful to his God-given work, even when he knew suffering was coming. Godly leaders must always flee sin and temptation, but they must not flee doing their duty in faithfulness to the Lord. There it is. That's my summary. Well, let's look at this. We'll get down page 34 a little bit. Round one. We're going to find four rounds, if you want to put it that way. The first is intrigue. While the completion of repairing the walls of Jerusalem was near and the opportunity for Israel's enemies to do something effective was rapidly coming to an end, Nehemiah receives and declines a deceptive invitation from his enemies to get him away from Jerusalem and assassinate him. The attacks now become personal and fixed entirely on Nehemiah. Leaders carry an invisible bullseye on their chests. Well, let's look at verses 1 and 2. Now when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors and the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, "Come and let us meet together at Hekapharim in the plan of Ono." But they intended to do me harm. Now this was about a day's trip outside Jerusalem, about 19 miles away. It was in neutral territory. But it takes Nehemiah away and makes him vulnerable. And it takes him away from what God had assigned him to do. So he doesn't do it. Okay? But notice verses 3 and 4. And I sent messengers to them saying, "I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it to come down?" And they sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same way. Four times. Why do you think they kept sending it to him? Four times. Come on, husbands. There you go. Karen rose up and spoke the truth. A true prophetess in Israel. If you nag a man enough, he's going to get tired and say, "Okay, I give in." And all the men said, and you women know it. You women know it.
But I don't need to do that today. I just want you to.
You just dropped from true.
If she asked me to do something, unless she knows it's going to be done. She didn't have to remind me every 6 months.
That reminds me of the story about the woman that said to her husband, "You never tell me you love me." He said, "I told you when we got married I love you. If it changes, I'll let you know." There you go. Well, this is leaders need not stubbornness. There's a big difference between stubbornness and perseverance. Stubbornness is a vice. Perseverance is a virtue. Stubbornness is usually selfish and wrong. Perseverance is positive and based on God's truth. But there's a certain kind of person that feels that they can get their way if I just keep wearing them down, wearing them down, wearing them down. Didn't Samson learn that lesson? How many times did Delilah ask, "Where's the strength of your hair? Oh, you deceived me. Tell me the truth this time." Should she ever give up? She knew. Men love peace. And they don't want to be, they get conflict at work. They don't want to come home and have conflict. So they give in. Leaders can be worn down. They get tired. And you have to go in before the Lord and pray and say, Lord, am I doing the right thing? And I don't want to give in because I'm tired. But if this is what you want, give me the strength to persevere. You just see it. There's a certain kind of person that feels that if I can't get my way the first time, I'll just keep nagging. Do not take no for an answer. A good salesman, Dan, right? A good salesman never takes no for an answer. But at a certain point, in spiritual things, this is not a virtue. It's not a virtue. So they're going to try to weaken his resolve. So they do intrigue. The second one is open slander. Nehemiah receives and declines a further and public demand from Sanballat to meet about a rumor that Nehemiah is planning a rebellion. So we see in verse 5, in the same way, Sanballat for the fifth time sent his servants to me with an open letter in his hand. What's the importance of not a sealed letter, but an open letter? What do you think, why he sent the open letter? Pardon?
Public.
Everybody can see it. Now, why does he want everybody to see it?
Put pressure
on him, yes. He wants the people to say, Nehemiah, we've been in this situation before, and we stopped building the wall for a long time because they kept bullying us, and we don't want to go through that again. Oh, the sand pellet's crafty, you know? And here's how they do it in church work. I'll tell you how they do it. In one church in which I served, we had three elders. I was one of three. I was the teaching elder, and the other two were ruling elders. But together with three of us made all our decisions together and so forth. Well, we had one guy that wanted his way. He wanted to do something. And he came to me, and I said, I don't think so. Well, what he did then is he went to another elder. And the other elder said, sounds good to me. Okay. So then he goes ahead and does what he proposed to do. So I immediately called the other two elders together, said, what's going on here? He asked me, and I said, no. And the other elder said, oh, it's my fault. He said, I said yes without thinking. What was he doing? It's called triangulation. Do your children know how to do that? Pardon me?
My cat knows how to do it.
Your cat knows how to do it? How does that work in your... So Bill's a soft touch. Bill, I need $20. That's called triangulation. You know, the kid knows that if I go to mom, she'll say no, so I'll go to dad. And he says yes. And then when mom gets mad, well, dad said I could do it. Now you've set those two against each other. And that's triangulation. And that's what they're trying to do here. It's called triangulation. And the way we did it with the three elders is we always tried to make sure we'd say, well, let me think about it, and I'll get together with the other two guys. Now, there was once in a while we'd have to make a decision, and the other two would say, yeah, okay, no problem, or, well, since you said yes, we'll do it. But we always worked together that way. And the result of this was that the guy, when he found out that the... that the elders got wise to him, well, he didn't stay in the church very long. He had shot his wad. He had gone ahead and tried to manipulate or triangulate. And that's what they're trying to do here. They're going to try to triangulate. They're not going to go to Nehemiah. They're going to go behind him to the people and see if we can't get the people to apply pressure on Nehemiah. Very tricky. Very tricky. Okay. And this, and then we'll go down here, go down page 35 very quickly. Sanballat begins with slander against Nehemiah. We see here three rumors and an implied threat. Rumor number one, it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem says, also says it, we got an eyewitness, we got a witness, that you and the Jews intend to rebel, and that's why you are building the wall. You're going to pit them against the Persians. The Persians go find out about this, they're not going to like it. Secondly, it was perhaps a misapplication of messianic promises, and according to these reports, you wish to become their king. The king is to be the Messiah. And the third rumor, you've arranged to have the prophets proclaim you as king. And you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. The implied threat is for I, that the king of Persia will hear that what you are doing and will take action against you. And now the king will hear these reports. How does Sanballat know the king of Persia is going to hear these reports? He's going to tell him. So you see, he's putting pressure on the leader. This is really tightening the screws. So we have Sanballat in the last part of verse 7 repeating his invitation. So now come and let us take counsel together. About what? Well, yeah. But notice Nehemiah's response in verses 8 and 9. In verse 8, he denies the slander. Then I sent to him saying, no such things as you say have been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind. And then he says, he understands what they're up to. They all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hand will drop from the work and it will not be done. So what does Nehemiah do? He says no to his critics, but who does he talk to next? God. But now, O God, strengthen my hand. And many a spiritual leader has had to go to the Lord and ask for strength. I am overwhelmed. I am overwhelmed. Yeah. I've been there. And you literally stay up all night wondering, how in the world did this happen? What do I do now? What are going to be the consequences? Believe me. And the pressure is on you, and you know what you're being asked to do is wrong, and you're being told you're a bully. You're being told you're doing this for your own personal ambition. All sorts of slanderous comments come at you. And I heard one guy say that if you call the shots, you're going to have to take the shots. And you do. You just have to. And being a spiritual leader, a pastor, is very tough. Because on one side, you have to have a tender heart. But on the other side, you have to have thick skin. And that's a hard combination to have. You can get discouraged in a heartbeat. And I have been there. And I was envious of Ruth Ann being able to sleep. And you go to bed and you lay there and you roll and roll and you get up and go in the front room, walk up and down the hallway, up and down the room, wondering what you're going to do. Then the sun comes up and you have to go back to work and you still wonder what. Yeah, I've been there. It's tough. And you get anonymous letters. I've been there. I've had people shun me. I've had people come up to me and say some of the ugliest things you could ever think a believer could say. And you have to stand there and smile and say, God bless you. Sometimes you can say, no, that's not true. Sometimes you, but you have to be careful. You have to be careful. We talked about it, didn't we, earlier? The lust of self-justification. You have to really, so you're wrestling, am I wrong? Show me, Lord. Show me, Lord. If I'm not wrong, give me strength. But if I am wrong, give me humility. And the Lord sometimes takes his time answering that prayer. And you have to just stay in his presence. And you mutter to yourself. Mutter to yourself. So this is where Nehemiah is. We're going to look at round three. He's going to get a religious persecution, a false prophet. We're going to stop right there. Are there any questions? Now, when we get to chapter 8, we're going to see this shift here. All of a sudden, we're going to see about how people walk with the Lord and how a group of people experiences revival. But that's at the end of start of chapter 8. Father in heaven, thank you for your word. May we be encouraged by it. Help us to ride it like a raft in a storm, because it's the only thing that we have in the long run that we can rely on. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.